Hey, folks, I want to tell you about a great new sports show from Star Talk, the people behind Neil deGrasse Tyson's hit science podcast, Star Talk Radio. The new show is called Playing with Science. Each episode, pro soccer player Gary O'Reilly and Star Talk Radio's co-host Chuck Nice recruit athletes, experts, and scientists to explore behind iconic moments in sports with guests like Lance Armstrong, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Hope Solo. Learn about the science behind Steph Curry's 40-foot set shot or technology that helped you Usain Bolt become the fastest man on earth. In the first episode, Chuck and Gary celebrate the game with Super Bowl champion players OCU Manura of the New York Giants and Santonio Holmes of the Pittsburgh Steelers, along with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. So check it all out. All you got to do is subscribe to Playing with Science from Star Talk in iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast. Welcome to the Ringer NBA Show, and joining us today on the show is Stu Jackson. He's a former coach, GM, and executive vice president of the NBA. You can now see him on Turner Sports, Turner Sports NBA analyst Stu Jackson. You can see him throughout the season on NBA TV's signature nightly studio show, Game Time, providing news, analysis, highlights from around the league. And NBA TV's Fan Night is going to feature James Harden and the Rockets hosting the Magic next Tuesday night. And Stu Jackson joins us now. Hey, Stu, thanks for coming on, man.
Hey, Chris, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be on.
So before, I want to go through this step by step because there's a lot I want to learn about you. First things first, congratulations on the Pac-12 Hall of Fame. I read that you're going to be inducted soon.
Yeah, they must have run out of candidates or something. But no, it's quite an honor, and it's very excited to hear from the Pac-12. And, you know, it's interesting, when I actually played in the league, it was the Pac-8 at that time. There were only 8 teams in the league, and, some of my ex-teammates were in ahead of me, but it's just a great honor, and I'm looking forward to it.
How'd you end up there? How'd you end up playing in the Pac-12 at Oregon, right?
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, I came out of high school in the early 70s, Chris, and at that time, the best two collegiate basketball leagues in the country, if you were like a high-level high school player, were really the ACC and the Pac-8. And I was from, Pennsylvania. My coach, who I played for at Oregon, was from Pennsylvania, who I knew of even as a middle school player. And back in the early 70s, to go and play basketball in the South really wasn't something that entered my mind. I mean, if you know, for those of you that remember those days, the only players that went to the South were like New Yorkers who played at Carolina or South Carolina. You had Ernie Grunfeld and Bernard King who went to Tennessee. But other than that, if you were a Northern player, you didn't consider playing there. So the Pac-8 at that time was comprised of a lot of Eastern and Midwestern players, you know, Gus Johnson and, you know, Andre McCarter, you know, played at UCLA, and a lot of the UCLA players. So it made perfect sense at that time to go to play the better basketball in the country, and I made the leap.
Had you ever been west of the Mississippi?
No. I had never flown on a plane until I took a recruiting visit, you know, but at that time you could take recruiting visits. You could take as many as you wanted, Chris. So I took a ton of them. It seemed like I was gone every weekend. And when I, you know, went to Oregon, it was just the antithesis of anything that I was used to growing up, and different environment, different lifestyle, and people seemed different. And they had a team that was really starting to take off. Ron Lee, who eventually became a lottery pick in the NBA draft, was a year ahead of me, and they were an up-and-coming program, and I could play right away, so there I went.
Hey, and there you go, right? You're going to get in the Pac-12 Hall of Fame, so it obviously all worked out. I wanted to ask you about something that actually an NBA front office member mentioned it to me about 2 weeks ago, and when I knew I was having you on, I was like, I've got to ask him about this, because you were at Providence with Pitino, and I was talking about Mike D'Antoni. It was actually when I was watching a Houston game, and you know, they were shooting like whatever it is, 40 plus threes a game, and then you watch Golden State and they shoot this ridiculous amount of threes, and Talk about how this has all happened recently and the way the NBA is going and that shot becoming so much more important than it used to be. And said front office exec says to me, you know who never gets credit for this is Pitino. And he was so far ahead of his time regarding the three-point shot. And now going back, I look, you were on the staff at the Providence team that Pitino took to the Final Four. And it's crazy, right? That we're talking like almost 30 years ago. But if you can, just like walk me through that and this whole idea that people don't typically bring up Pitino when it comes to really using the three-point shot at the as a weapon, yet, I mean, it's almost 30 years ago you guys pulled that off.
Yeah, Chris, you know, you've really done your homework. And, you know, that fact about Rick Pitino is something that I talk about to anyone that will listen as much as I can say it, because you're correct. He really was the pioneer of the utilization of the three-point shot. And I can tell you, I can remember like it was yesterday. You know, Rick liked to, you know, have a lot of meetings with his staff, and I was on his staff at the time. And I remember the day he brought us into the sauna at Alumni Hall at Providence College, because he liked to meet in the sauna. He liked to work out and then have a meeting in the sauna to see who would, you know, drop out first. But I remember to this day, he sat down on a magnetic board and, you know, with a Sharpie or with, you know, a pen, and showed us the math. And he said, listen, you know, with this team, if we take, you know, X amount of three-point shots and shoot 33%, it's better than taking X amount of shots and shooting 40%. And we're all sort of, you know, taking our fingers to our heads, scratching our heads, but he was right. And, you know, that decision to play the way that he wanted to play, which was a full-court pressing style of play, we really were aggressive, getting out after you, trying to turn you over. But when we came down offensively, we played basketball inside and out, but we were looking for the three-point shot, and we took an abundance of them and made it abundance of them. And it was a primary reason that allowed that Providence College team to eventually go on to the Final Four, with a team that was talented, but not as talented as most teams that we played. You know, led by the likes of Billy Donovan, who, you know, is now the coach at the Oklahoma City Thunder, Delray Brooks, Darryl Wright, Carlton Screen, Pop Lewis. You know, all of these guys were prolific three-point shooters. And that was their mission, and their objectives was to take as many as they could in lieu of taking a two-point shot. And to this day, that guy, Rick Pitino, is the pioneer of, you know, the early analytic style of play of taking threes.
Did you guys get criticized the same way that an NBA team still to this day? I mean, you will find some analysts that say, yeah, it's all fine and dandy that Houston takes a million threes, or even with Golden State, right? That a jump shooting team, there is still in some quarters a sneer towards it. I mean, we're talking almost 30 years ago. Did you face that same level of criticism when you guys were shooting all those threes playing in the Big East?
Chris, not at all, because, you know, again, we were on the forefront, the pioneers of playing that way. It was something that was new. You know, focus groups and data on fans, to this day, you know, fans feel that a three-point shot is just an exciting shot. So we had a collegiate team that was playing an exciting style of play, taking three-point shots that fans love, making them, winning some games. We faced no criticism, and we were like, you know, the innovators, the new kids on the block. Today, I think some teams take criticism in the NBA primarily because we're getting, you know, close to that pressure point where teams now, everyone takes them, everyone participates in what I'll call the analytic style of play, and we're getting to the pressure point where we're beginning to maybe take too many. And the game is getting a little bit more, homogenous, for lack of a better term. And, you know, because everybody's doing the same thing. But the Providence Friars, we were, you know, something new. It was innovative. It was exciting and fun to watch. So we took no criticism.
Why do you think it took so long for the NBA to catch on? Because if we go back in time on that staff that you were a part of, it clearly worked, and a team that was at a talent disadvantage ended up making the Final Four. So the proof was in the pudding. You guys made a Final Four at Providence without five-star recruits, per se, and yet it took so long. I suppose, you know, Patino did it with his Kentucky teams, but those Kentucky teams were loaded with talent, and so people could discard it, but they could say, less attention is paid to the style of play when you do it with the best players, I suppose. But why do you think it took so long for the NBA to catch on?
Well, it's interesting. You know, throughout the early 90s into the late 90s, the NBA was experiencing their own style of play dilemma. If you remember back then, it was really that during that period of time that the NBA game came to a grinding halt. And it came to a grinding halt because it was so physical, and oftentimes success in the NBA was predicated on how well you did in the weight room, because you could grab, you could hold, you could, you know, take away people's athleticism rebounding wise and put your arm bar on offensive players or hand check and really slowed the game down. So there wasn't this opportunity to get out and rebound and run because teams just wouldn't allow you. There were less possessions in the game. They were able to hold and be physical. So it really hurt the NBA game during that time. They were not even entertaining thoughts about opening up the game, and it really wasn't until 2001 when the NBA implemented a rules package that really opened up the NBA basketball game and allowed players to not only penetrate but also to cut, and allowed a little bit more freedom of movement, which is a famous phrase today. And when that happened, coupled with the fact that NBA teams then started to make personnel decisions based upon those rules packages, and when I say that, put more of an emphasis on skill and shooting, as that started to evolve, the NBA game just blossomed. Because of the rules change, because of the personnel decisions, whereas in college, we made those personnel decisions right away. We just wanted guys that could shoot the ball because we knew what style we were going to play. It just took the NBA a little bit longer, but they had to legislate it first. And then teams began to make those personnel decisions, and this is what you have today. You know, the Golden State Warriors, the Houston Rockets, the Cleveland Cavaliers, the San Antonio Spurs, which are these wide-open, free-flowing, basketball teams, which is fun to watch.
All right, Stu, I want to ask you about levying fines and punishments in the NBA. But first, today's podcast brought to you by Sherry's Berries. There's no one like your Valentine. This year, treat them to an unforgettable gift that's as unique as they are. You love your girl and you want to get her something good, and you're going to be stressed out thinking, don't be the guy that goes to like Walgreens and grabs the last, Russell Stover's chocolates and a balloon or whatever. Do something good this year. Sherry's Berries. And I promise you, they are delicious. And a gift from Sherry's Berries shows her you put thought into finding the perfect gift. Freshly dipped strawberries from Sherry's Berries start at just $19.99 plus shipping, or double the berries for just $10 more. Just go to berries.com and use my code NBAshow. Help support our show by supporting our sponsors. Use my code NBAshow. With Valentine's Day right around the corner, there's only one way to get Sherry's Berries starting at $19.99. Just visit berries.com. That's berries.com. Click on the microphone in the top right-hand corner and type in NBA show. That's berries.com and use my code NBA show. Help support our show by supporting our sponsors. Use my code NBA show. After your stint of coaching and general managing in the NBA, you take this job in the NBA front office, and one of your primary jobs is being the guy that has to hand out fines and punishments. What is that job like? Because clearly, we even go back to last year's finals. Many people believe that it was dictated by the fines slash punishments that were levied. There's still a lot of people that run around saying if Draymond Green wouldn't have been suspended for Game 5, it might have been a different outcome last year. Whether that's true or not, it's a point of view. You were the guy that was once in charge of said fines and punishments. What is that job like? What all does it entail?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the most public part of that job as the head of basketball operations, which is now held by Kiki Vandeweghe, are the fines and, you know, the penalties that are given to teams and players. But the reality is that the job is a little bit more than that. You know, as being in charge of basketball operations, you really are the quote-unquote quality control department for the product, because you're in charge of everything that surrounds the game. And that goes from things that are as mundane as the equipment that you use on a game, whether it's the lights or the stanchions or the baskets or the rims, or, you know, how the floor is painted and, you know, how it's finished, you know, the benches and how many people can sit there, how many people can't, how many coaches you have on a bench. So all of those, you know, decorum type things around the game are something that you're in charge of. And also, at least during my time, I was also chairman of the competition committee, and that committee was faced with making recommendations on rules and rules changes to the board of governors or the owners that directly shape the game, like the rules package in 2001 and then again in 2004. So you could have a direct impact on the quality or the impact of the game just by, you know, the rules. And then there are sort of other decorum type areas like uniforms and you know, the players wear. I also was in charge of the referees in terms of how the game was called. So, you know, you throw all of that in, and you really are the quality control department for the league. But as part of that, you also want to, or part of your mission is to maintain a level of decorum and to make the game safe for players who come to work every day. And that's where you get into areas of, you know, violence on the court, fighting, and hard fouls, and behavior, you know, technical fouls by both players and coaches. And that's the most public part of the job, but not the essence of the job. But I will say this, that it's vitally important, and my view was always that you have to protect, you know, the players from themselves. I mean, these are the greatest athletes in the world, bar none. They're highly competitive. They play the game aggressively. They're highly skilled. And the game in that short confines of, you know, 94 feet by, you know, 40, 50 is an intense environment that, if not managed correctly, could really lead to some bad things happening, like injuries or, you know, fighting and that type of thing, as we've seen in the past. So it's really incumbent upon whoever is in charge of the game or the caretaker of the game that you maintain that safety for players to go to work. And that's why you hand out fines as a deterrent to, you know, bad behavior. And when you don't do that, you know, players, boy, they're smart. I mean, players are really smart. And as soon as they figure out that there's some leniency or the line is moved, they're going to figure it out and they'll try to take advantage of it competitively. And sometimes players get hurt.
Is there anything that has been established or implemented since you left that job that you feel like you would have fought against?
Well, and you know, that's interesting. I fought against, you know, is a little bit strong. I mean, there have been some times where, you know, some decisions have been made that I didn't necessarily agree with. But, you know, that's the NBA's prerogative, and I'm no longer in that position and don't have the opportunity to make those recommendations. But
give me an example.
By and large,
give me an example.
Well, I think the biggest one, and that's a fair question, it was the Draymond Green kick to Steven Adams. You know, we all remember that, where, you know, he wasn't suspended. That particular one, and I was on record as saying I thought personally, and again, this is my opinion, not the NBA's opinion, that that contact and the flagrant foul rule really is a contact rule. That contact was so severe that it endangered another player, and I thought as a way to deter future actions by that player or other players from kicking players that it need to be dealt with a little bit more severely. But again, that's my opinion. But, you know, and I probably wouldn't have recommended that he not be suspended, and I mean, that he would have been suspended, and unfortunately he wasn't, which, you know, the rest you can, you know, in that series and the other series, you can decide and make your own mind up. But that's an example.
Do you think that it does your opinion change given the stakes of the game? Because many fans go, listen, there should not be, you know, suspensions the same way there are during the season when it gets to the highest level, to the point where it could feasibly dictate who holds the trophy up.
I think during that part of the season, it's even more important that you are conscious of you know, maintaining consistency with respect to penalties, because during that time of the season, in the playoffs, the level of aggression, the speed of the game, the intensity and competitiveness of the game is at an all-time high. And if you move the line during that time, you know, bad things can really happen. And that's what I always worry about, you know, is that sort of like, you know, almost like gladiator type environment, you know, in the playoffs. What you want to try to attain is a fair game, one that, you know, has a, you know, a minimal physicality to it, because you know that during the playoffs, players move faster, the airspace between offense and defense is minimal, and certainly much less than during the regular season. Players emotionally are at their all-time peak game to game. You've got a day's preparation in between games. So, again, it's a powder keg for something bad to happen. So when you do have something bad to happen, keeping with my philosophy that you have to be a deterrent, when it does happen, you have to deal with it directly, swiftly, and severely when it's warranted. And, you know, so it doesn't happen again, because, you know, you've got all these teams in the playoffs playing all these games, and there's so much at stake that is the type of environment where something could happen in a game that directly affects the brand of the NBA. And at the end of the day, that's what you want to protect.
All right,
that and the safety of players.
Last question based on that. Do you think that your opinion on that is because of the malice in the palace and the NBA, for that matter's opinion on things like that? Because when you talk about, you know, it being high voltage and something bad could happen, it feels like that would be the last example that people would come up as something catastrophic happening within a game. Is your opinion on these things and dealing with them swiftly and firmly almost shell shock from that whole thing taking place, which is now over a decade ago?
Well, it's interesting. Even prior to the malice in the palace, that's the philosophy that we maintained. But certainly that was a wake-up call. I mean, to have that happen in any professional sport, an incident of that magnitude that raises to the level where you're on the front page of the New York Times the next day, you know, that can never happen again. And so the answer to your question in short is sort of. You know, the philosophy was, you know, was that way before, but then after it was a wake-up call and certainly heightened. And we, you know, as the NBA or a lover of the NBA, that's something you never want to have happen in the game again.
He is Stu Jackson. He is a Turner Sports NBA analyst. You can see him throughout the season on NBA TV's signature nightly show, Game Time, providing news highlights and analysis from around the league. Remember, next Tuesday night, it's going to feature the Beard, James Harden, hosting the Magic, the Rockets hosting the Magic on NBA TV's Fan Night. Stu, you're the man. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Hey, Chris, thank you for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Appreciate it. That's going to do it for today's Ringer NBA show. If you dig what you're hearing, go give us a rating and review on iTunes, and we will talk to you tomorrow.